I'm your co-host, Christopher Mukigana Harrington, joined from the state of New York, from the last time from the studio apartment, Mr. Brandon Howard Thurston, the mover. Brandon, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm this is the last time again, one last time, the last time. I've moved furniture. I've moved beds, couches. I've moved a couch all the way across this municipality to the other side of town, and discovered that the couch doesn't even fit in the new apartment. Had to give it away.
Oh, no.
So I've got...
Oh, you gave it away already?
Yeah, I just gave it away. Screw it. I don't want it anymore. It's this. The new apartment is smaller than the current apartment, and we got the U-Haul, moved the couch over there, got it inside the new apartment, and I was like, this isn't going to work at all. This living room is way too small for this big, curvy couch. Let's just take it to the Goodwill. And that's what we did. And there's still more to do. I have to clean this apartment out to avoid getting my security deposit withheld. So I've got just until Tuesday at 10 a.m. the final inspection. So as soon as
my
we're
goodness.
Done...
Did you get done. Any of your students to recognize that they could become better professional wrestlers by helping you move?
Well, one of my students did help me move the furniture, yes.
He
was compensated, though. He was paid a fair wage. Because they've been taught how to...
You weren't a pro wrestling promoter, as some would allegate.
No. So, yeah, I've got to clean this thing out. I don't know. I've got to get rid of a bunch of things. I've got more stuff back in the room. Yeah. So this will maybe an uncut version of the WrestleNomics radio here. Usually there are many edits and there are many tangents and socialist rants that I go on that are usually edited out of this program, but not today. There's not enough time to do all that editing today. This week.
No. You got to go across town. You got to become part of South Tonawanda. And leave your North Tonawanda home.
That's right. I've had enough of North Tonawanda. I'm moving to South Tonawanda. No, I'm moving to the city of Buffalo. So, yeah.
Wait, weren't you going to wrestle on a show yet last night?
So I wrestled last night, yeah. I did some additional moving in the morning, afternoon, and then I wrestled in Fort Erie, Ontario last night for Bordertown Pro Wrestling. And I teamed with Terrell Kenneth. We are the patron saints of professional wrestling. We wrestled the fraternity of Channing Decker and Bradford Montague. And yeah, we lost, but it was a good match. Good time.
Did you say his name is Bradford Montague?
I believe that's how it's pronounced.
That is an incredible name.
Yes.
So this is our second video broadcast for the week here. We thought we'd try it again. It's always fun too, because then we can, you know, do YouTube comments if anyone does want to comment while we're going on. If you are a premium subscriber to WrestleNomics, you get our WrestleNomics premium content, which included Thursday all day coverage, where we put out our notes, we put out a audio visual presentation, we put out the podcast version of that audio visual presentation. We gave the $10 patrons access to all of the files that we've been doing. I was just uploading some more today onto the WrestleNomics Drive. And of course, we answer questions and look at other things. So what you might hear on this episode is going to be a little bit of a repeat of what we talked about on Thursday. But the thousands of you that do not yet subscribe, thousands, Brandon, thousands. How does that feel?
That feels like there's a lot of room for me to possibly quit my job here if the thousands would just sign up.
Yeah, we're at WWE stock at the $40 level. It's we never thought we'd get there.
That's true.
But look, $80 is right around the corner for all we know.
Yep,
so,
yep.
But for the thousands you haven't heard us go through the rant, we'll quickly go through some of the information. And there's a little bit more of a nuanced view on some of this because obviously we've had a few more days to analyze and consider. But overall, it's going to be a lot of the same material. So we also hope to supplement it with a little bit more Berrios talk, as we always have on this this channel here. Because Brandon, you know, it was fun tweeting things out on Thursday, and then it takes a few days for people to catch up. And so on Friday, I had a very interesting conversation.
Did you?
Yes, I was called by a reporter from a major newspaper.
Major one.
I will not say which major. Newspaper yet, because I'm hoping this becomes an article of some sort. But, you know, maybe it will never happen. And then I will just seem like I was making this whole thing up, which yes. I'd rather just not say anything about which one it was and then seem like mysterious rather than just be a straight up liar.
A major publication. Was it, was it Life magazine?
It could have been. It could have been. It could have been for highlights. It could have been for any one of the numerous people who enjoy talking about WWE on a given day. But they asked me a lot of questions about the stock, and it was more of a column that was not as much about a factual take on things as much as maybe saying it was a take on the idea that there's a lot of enthusiasm for the stock right now, and that maybe it's a good investment, maybe it's not a good investment, but why the heck is it doing this? You know, if we look at this 5-year chart, which hopefully is popped up on your screen right now.
Can you zoom in on that?
I'll zoom in on that a little bit. Bring that in. It starts out, and you can see 2014, it was $9.91 about 5 years ago on August 16th, 2013. And then we had this giant run in 2014 where the stock went as high as $31 in early March. And then finally, they announced their new deal in May, and the stock crashed from $17 to $11 almost overnight. Really bad time. And then the stock has just slowly been climbing up. They go ahead, they launch the network. You know, the numbers aren't always as good as they hope it's going to be. And they're climbing up, and now they're in the $20 range in the late 2015. And then they're in the $17 range in 2016. And then they're in the $18, $19 range in 2017. And then midway through 2017, things start getting hot where the stock starts creeping up and creeping up. And by, say, November of 2017, we're up to $27. And by January of 2018, we're actually above $31. We've now beat the all-time high here for this WWE stock, or at least the relative all-time high. And then there's this cliff, right? You can see here between March of 2018, it was at $35. And by July of 2018, it's at $83 and closed on Friday at $81.75. So this is really, to me, the cliff. You know, this is the there's a whole lot of things that must be going into what's happening in WWE for them to explode in this way. And some of it has to be driven by actual financials, and some of this has to be driven but just by boundless hope and hype. And we see boundless hope and hype had an effect in 2014, but not nearly the effect that we're seeing now, partially because they've delivered on at least one of the most major initiatives, the domestic TV deals contract.
Yeah. I would guess this slow growth in 2016 and 17 is sort of this cautious optimism about what's the next round of TV rights fees going to be like. And as we get closer and closer to them announcing the deal, the optimism gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and you know, in March of 2014, I remember that there was rumors circulating all around, and I wrote a What Culture column about it at the time. And there's all these rumors that, you know, AMC was really interested, or A&E was really interested in WWE programming and all this other stuff, and that one of them was going to do a big, you know, either takeover bid, or they were going to bid a whole bunch of money to get Raw. Mm-hmm. So talking to this reporter, one of the questions he kind of asked me is, he just goes, you know, George is a smart cookie, right? And, you know, he's the guy to trust. He gets it, right? And I gave him kind of my WrestleNomics answer of Brandon and I. I did not mention his WrestleNomics Hall of Fame induction, Brandon. I'm sorry.
Come on.
But I just basically said, I think he's really good at talking to investors. I think he really wants to be the head of a new media company. Mm-hmm. And I think he very much is excited that WWE is in a position where they can greatly increase their value as live entertainment. I don't know if he knows a thing about the business of professional wrestling. And to this reporter, all he looks at is the stock, and he says, who cares? It doesn't matter. What does it matter if he doesn't know the names of the major stars? And my whole point was, when I read this review of what happened in Q2, there are some warning signs to me. There are some bells, some, what are they called, klaxons or something, that are going off in the back of my head. I'd say, maybe something. You know, that's like the alarm noise. Like, maybe it's on a starship. But it's just, there's certain little things that kind of irk me. But at the same time, it's money. It's real money. Almost all of this is based on real money. As much as I try to discount the Saudi deal, it's based on real money that they're going to receive.
Mm-hmm. I think George has done a lot to guide WWE through these TV rights deals, and he's done a lot to understand new media in the right way, especially when there's a lot of skepticism, I think, from the investment community probably in general, and definitely from the wrestling media commentary community, whatever that means. Like, I mean, not that George necessarily cares about what those people say, but just that there's a lot of doubt about, like, well, what does all this social media mean? And I mean, we still don't know a great deal about what it really means in terms of finances. TV ratings were going down over these years, over this very graph that we're looking at. TV ratings mostly declined. And there's a lot of worry about, well, if TV ratings are down, how are they going to get another increase in TV rights when the next round comes around here in 2018-19? But they did. And he made these deals, helped make these deals anyway happen. And that's why he is a WrestleNomics Hall of Famer. Himself and Michelle Wilson.
And he and Michelle are obviously being rewarded for their position by becoming co-presidents this year.
Yeah.
And part of that elevation has been what I'd consider a business consolidation, where they have taken power throughout the company. There is many lines that used to report to Vince McMahon that no longer report to them. International used to be its own separate line going straight up. And it used to be that there was probably four or five different EVPs that were going up through the company. And now it's George and Michelle. And in a sense, I would actually say it's the comeback story for Michelle Wilson, because she stayed with it for this whole period here. You kind of would have thought maybe George would be the one that would get all the way up. But you do see Michelle actually also being brought up with him, and that they've now reconsolidated all of the lines of reporting so that it pretty much goes up through either Michelle or George. And I don't know if that many other people report to Vince McMahon anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we went through this period right after the network was launched in 2014, where there were all these different WWE Network czars. You probably remember the names of them better than I do.
Well, I mean, there was the Network czars. Yeah, exactly. There was Perkins Miller.
Lou Schwartz. There was
Lou Schwartzman, who was the CIO or the IT kind of side of guy. Mm-hmm. There was obviously Fox was her name, Lisa Ann Fox or something like that.
Lisa Lee Fox, I believe.
Yeah. And a couple other people who came through, and it was always this question of who's in charge, who's in charge. And George, in one of his calls that was kind of unregulated at one of these investor conferences, I actually put that question in the Q&A thing, and they asked him, and he basically is like, I guess you could say all of us are in charge.
Yeah.
And of course they are, I do believe, very focused on the WWE Network. I will say, so much of what in my mind has been the improvement on the WWE Network has probably actually come from the other teams that have been working on the data analytics side, where you get to, what is it, Tandy O'Donohue and her analytics team that works on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, Just around as we go through this here, I'd like to end with just kind of a second take on what is it that we think was good about Q2, and then what is the future for WWE right now? Because the WrestleMania quarter is usually a fascinating quarter, because not only does it have the high revenue of WrestleMania, but usually actually has the low profitability of WrestleMania, where it's actually one of their least profitable quarters sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's this weird dichotomy.
That's because of... We now live in this sort of post pay-per-view world where you're going to get a lot of the money that WrestleMania is drawing throughout the year, right? Because WrestleMania is almost a loss leader now, instead of being this one event that you're going to pay $60 for or whatever it is. The hope is that you're offering WrestleMania as part of this OTT service for $9.99 a month. People subscribe and they stay subscribed year round.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure if WrestleMania ever was the profit-leading quarter for WWE. I would have to go back and really check how it's been. I know since 2014 it's been bad. I mean, I can show that, very easily on I have it for 2015 just sitting here in front of me. Mm-hmm. What I'm looking at is, what is the media margin for WWE on operating income as a percentage. Now, I don't know how visible this is to people. I can zoom in a little bit, maybe. Are you able to read this at all, Brandon?
I can kind of see it on my view. Okay. I think it needs to be zoomed in on, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go to view. See where it says 100%. Just make that bigger.
Ha-ha! There we go. All right. So just to kind of put in that in perspective. So Q 2015, Q1 was WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. 2016, Q2 was WrestleMania. 2017, Q2 was WrestleMania. 2018, Q2 is WrestleMania. And the thing you'll notice is in each one of these times, the media percentage for operating income percentage is way down. So in 2015, the margin percentage, the operating income percentage for the media segment, which includes, you know, a lot of the money that they're getting through pay-per-view and but more over the WWE Network, it's 8% in Q1, and then it jumps up to 16% for the average for the year with a high of 23% in Q3. In 2016, it's negative 1.5, and the average for the year is 16.2, but the other three quarters are more like 22, 27, 19%. And in 2017, it's 7%, whereas the next quarter it was 33%. And the quarter after that, it was 27%. And again, that includes some TV rights in there too. But just to kind of put it in perspective of like, it's WrestleMania is always the low quarter for WWE in terms of the profitability, which is funny because the revenue usually spikes way up that quarter.
It's because WrestleMania is such an expensive event to run, right?
Yes. And because they're holding so many different so many different elements of what they spend for WrestleMania, both the marketing side, the building side, the talent side. You know, it costs a lot to pay The Rock, and everything else, the travel and all the other events that are running with that.
So the conclusion, the conclusion I'm getting from this is that W should stop doing WrestleMania.
No, that is not my conclusion.
Oh.
but I think their accounting leaves an interesting spikes and peaks and valleys for sure. Mm-hmm. So when I look here, if we just go through kind of what happened in this quarter, what's interesting, what's notable, what's intriguing. When we look at the revenue side here, WWE Network revenues, including pay-per-view, $56 million for this quarter. Last year at this time is $52. Core content rights, $66. Last year at this time it was $60. Advertising and sponsorship, $19.6. Last year it was $13.1. And then other, and they mentioned here at the other forms of media monetization reflect revenues earned from the distribution of other content, including but not limited scripted, reality, and other in-ring programming, as well as theatrical and direct-to-home video.
Does it say anything about oil money in there?
No, oil money is not mentioned, but it would include some WWE Studios money.
Mm.
Mm.
So maybe this quarter it was
60.6. Last quarter it was 11.9.
So maybe it's just W Studios. Those movies are finally paying off, right? Is that why that section of the business is so big this time?
I don't see anything in the 10Q statement that I look through that suggests that's what's happening.
No.
What, in fact, I would suggest that is a giant lump sum of money that is showing up in other media rather than, say, live events for international, and that's the Saudi money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the ticket sales for Saudi money, it's only 13.5 million, or for international, it's 13.5 this quarter, 12.4 last quarter. So it's up by 1.1, but that's not a big jump.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I am going to guess that approximately $45 million came from the GSA money this quarter.
Yeah.
And
they're justifying,
where did I get this $45 million number from?
Yeah, and real quick, they're justifying putting it in that other segment because they've made it a WWE Network event, so like it's not just a live event, I guess. So it doesn't go under live events. Because, well, we put it on the network, we broadcast it live and all this, so it's a, you know, media content.
Yeah, and you could also say that it's the amount of money that they are getting for a fixed fee to produce programming, right? Much like a TV show, mm-hmm. much like Raw or SmackDown. They get that money regardless of one person shows up to the arena or 10,000.
Uh-huh.
So somebody online asked, is this on the drive if you're trying to follow along? It is on the drive if you're trying to follow along. It's in the WrestleNomics folder. There's a subfolder called Harrington WrestleNomics, and then you'll see the spreadsheet WWE Q1 2015 to Q2 2018 revised segments. Apologies for not calling that out in advance. So here's my first thing I'd say is when we look at it, this segment was 8.9 last quarter, and it's 60.6 today. So that's an increase of almost $49 million. So why am I only allotting maybe $45 million? Well, the reason for that is if you look at how much other has gone up over the last couple quarters here, it is up in Q1 versus Q1 of last year. It is up in Q4 versus Q4 of last year. It is up in Q3 versus Q3 of last year. Mm-hmm. So all three quarters before the Saudi deal supposedly started, we saw an increase in other. In fact, we saw a pretty big increase. I'm guessing almost 32% increase. So let's say that what if this quarter was up 32% from last year? So Q2 of last year, it was 11.9. So if we say it's going to be about 32% higher, that'd be about a 15, 16 million quarter is what we should have expected to see. But we saw 60. So what's the difference between 60 and 15? It's about $45 million. So I am guessing it's about a $45 million deal. Now, what we do not know about this deal, and what they did not answer questions on the call in a meaningful way to address, is one, will this deal replicate anytime soon? Meaning, will we see this as an annual $45 million? Will we see it more than $45 million next year? Or will we even see more money in this year for a Saudi event? And originally, when the Saudi event happened, as you might recall, Brandon, and I recall, there was a website called the Riyadh Report, and they put out a statement saying that we would see another event in the Saudi cities somewhere either in probably October or November. I can't remember which date they said.
I think
it
was it's November, and that sounds about right, because that's when they usually do an international tour, is in November, right? So I wonder, is, you know, the 45, 50, maybe even $60 million to do the Greatest Royal Rumble. Are they going to receive another payment in November and report it? I would think so, but probably a smaller one. I wonder what's it going to be like next year? You know, this is a 10-year deal, right? So is it going to be another $40 to $50 million payment next year? Or is it just like this was really front-loaded and the Greatest Royal Rumble was this big one-time event that's bigger than all the rest?
Yeah. So I'm guessing that it's reasonable to assume this year that we will see anywhere from $40 to $60 million of Saudi money coming through. I think this $60 million number, that's a possibility. I really do, based on, you know, everything from my own analysis of this data to talking to other people to just all the dark DMs that are out there on the web. It could be any one of those things, but maybe it will be, we'll see 45 this quarter and 15 next quarter. Maybe it was 40 this quarter and 20 next quarter. You know, we don't really know what the exact details would be, but my guess is that we'll see another big number come through in Q4. And I don't think this number is going to dramatically increase. I don't think that, you know, next year it's going to be 66 and the next year it's 70, then 77. You know, I think it's going to be 60 for 10 years, 600 million, something like that.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it's an escalating rights fee like their TV deals.
Yeah, me as well. So my take on this is that WWE probably got about $45 million of positive impact this last quarter on their revenue side because of the GSA money, and that is not being broken out in a meaningful way in their data. So what would be nice to do as I go through these numbers here is to make sure that I kind of compare it with and without that Saudi money. Now, what makes it nice is it pretty much only hits one line, right? It pretty much hits just the other on the live, on the media segment is what it's impacting. So almost everything else on this is going to stay the same. Let's finish up just kind of going through what we saw in the numbers here, and then we can kind of do a comparison. So the next big number to compare here, maybe I'll do this on the trending schedule for a second. And I'll just zoom in and see if I can pull to the right. Nope, that was not successful. There we go. We'll do it this way. Sorry, got to go over here so you see my stuff. We see 33.5 million for live event North American ticket sales versus 35.9 last year. So it's actually down a little bit. 13.5 versus 12.4. And 0.9, for international, and then advertising and sponsorship is 0.9 versus 0.7. And then this other category called other, is 4.4 versus 3.8. And when you go down to the footnote about what that is, it basically says it's the sale of travel packages and also commissions they get through secondary ticketing. So that's, I think, their, what is it, StubHub deal that they have?
Yep, StubHub.
Yeah. So all in all,
you think they're getting
media,
some percentage of the StubHub sales then of the resale ticket prices or
yes.
tickets? Yeah,
and we see here that live events were actually flat for the year. They're down 1%. It was 52.3 versus 52.8 versus total media was up 202.6 versus 137.2. But if we took out the $45 million, it would be more like quickly. What is that math? 202.6 minus what? $45 million.
155 or so, 157.
I get 157. Yeah. Yep. So 158, which still would be, you know,
bigger
maybe
than
a 15% growth, but it's a lot less than the 48% growth. And if you look at the last three quarters for WWE, Q2, Q3, Q4, Q1, they grew their media segment at 13, 15, 14, 10%. So again, it makes a lot more sense to assume that the media growth is growing more like 15% a quarter year over year versus 48%, because it's being really diluted by this one-time payment, or not a one-time payment, it's a reoccurring payment, but this one-time bulk payment they got.
Yeah.
So media, big thumbs up. Live events, flat. And then consumer products, 10.8 versus 9.4, 7.8 versus 6.8, 8.1 versus 8.4. I was saying what licensing, venue, merchandising, and e-commerce is.
Yeah.
All three of those were up about 10%, 26.7 versus 24.6. But all in all, that's not a huge consumer product segment, and nor is that a big amount of growth, mm-hmm. especially considering last quarter it was down 33%. And that is somewhat to do with the timing of their revenue recognition on their commissions and other things, on the royalties on things, because of the change they have in the FASB standard. So that's harder for me to, you know, really say is that good or bad, except for to say that's where we stand today. So all in all, when you look at where we are for WWE numbers, if we had taken out the Saudi money number, instead of being up 31% for this quarter, they would be up more like, see if I have it on my other sheet here. They would be up a lot less. It's probably the easiest way to put it.
Yeah.
So one thing I was also trying to figure out is how much of their operating income was driven by the extra amount of the Saudi deal. And how does it compare kind of year over year if we took it out? And what I had to assume is, let's assume the margin on the media segment is the same, regardless of whether Saudi money's in there. So it was about 15.8%. And so if we just assume that it really is 15.8%, then we would probably drop our overall operating margin for this business from maybe 12% over the last four quarters to 11.2, or it would drop from 11.6 for this one quarter to 7.5.
Yeah.
So it would be a substantial drop. And adjusted OIBDA would be down. I figure it would be down, you know, anywhere from, you know, it'd be down by almost $45 million,
so
honestly.
What's the number in adjusted OIBDA, you think, without $45 million of Saudi money? Is that shown
for
here?
For this quarter,
I just want to compare that to
Q2. I did it for Q4 rolling number,
yeah.
But it would just be... have to subtract these last couple quarters.
Look at all this math. For anyone listening on the audio only version, look at this. This math is unbelievable. You can see this Excel spreadsheet just going to work live before your eyes. Mookie's probably using the keyboard for this too, by the way. No mouse needed.
Yeah, I don't believe in mouses.
Mice.
Yeah. I don't like my number for this. I feel like you've asked me a question that somehow I should be able to answer easily, and now I can't. We'll get back to that.
Yeah. Well, the moral of the story is I think adjusted OIBDA would be way down. I'm just curious to compare that to what was adjusted OIBDA in Q2 2017 compared to Q2 2018, and, you know, take the oil money away. How are they doing?
Yeah, I mean, adjusted OIBDA in Q2 of 2018 is $43.5 million, and in 2017 was $24.3 million, so it increased by, you know, almost $20 million, I think $19 million, and a lot of that would have been the difference of just the Saudi money. Specifically, you know, when I look here also at what has happened for overall adjusted OIBDA over the last four quarters. So,
and like the, this Greatest Royal Rumble event probably wasn't, well, yeah, I guess it was. I'm trying to say that it wasn't very expensive for WWE, but they still had to pay. They probably had
travel,
to pay
travel.
Yeah,
they had to pay
talent.
All the stadium fees of bringing all their stuff over there and getting it set up. All that, you know, assumably all those fireworks and things like that that they were doing.
Yeah.
And then just all the cost of getting everybody there, taking all the opportunity cost of all the people they had to bring over to that couldn't be working on other things and had to get travel there. Yeah. I found that over the last four quarters, WWE's operating income was about $103.9 million. And my estimate is if you took out the Saudi money, it would probably have dropped to about $92.8 million, which is a difference of about $11 million. So if we were to say Q2 would not have been 21.2, it would have actually been about 10.1. It actually would have been down quarter over quarter.
Yeah.
Because last year is 10.7. So my argument would be operating income would pretty much be flat for WWE year over year if it wasn't for the fact that they had this Saudi money to kind of offset a lot of that.
Yeah. So I guess the moral of the story to me is that because they made this deal with the government in Saudi Arabia, their business looks a lot stronger than it really is. It's still doing okay without it, but it looks really strong with it. And they're going to go back there probably in November and get even, you know, several more $1 million out of that. And no women will be on that show either probably. But hey, there's a WWE Evolution pay-per-view, so hey, it's all okay. The women are going to have their own show. So what do we think about like the timing of that pay-per-view being announced? As most people listening probably know, this past Monday, Stephanie McMahon made history and announced that there's going to be a women's only pay-per-view, WWE Evolution. Do you recall the date? We can look that up real quick.
But I think it's right in the beginning of October, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in October. So that's happening, and so there'll be a pay-per-view that will be all women, and then the women will get a fee for that, surely, but then they won't be involved in the November event in Saudi Arabia. They weren't involved in the Greatest Royal Rumble. So I think it's, I think we were talking about it a little off air. It's like, is it kind of a PR move? Well, of course it is. But like, to what extent, what goes into that decision-making process, I guess, hey, let's announce that we're going to do this women's only pay-per-view to sort of take the heat off of us about we're making this deal with Saudi Arabia that doesn't even let us bring the women, you know, on the show.
Well, I think you're right in the sense that it's a way to save face. Two things with this. Number one, if this deal is $45 million or $60 million, that is such an enormous revenue stream for WWE. You can see why they're reluctant to use a morality standpoint and just stand up and say, nope, we refuse to take it because it's such a large amount of money. Number two, they have been pushing their direction towards the women's evolution, the women's revolution, the give divas the chance, all those things for years. So I don't think that the two are linked at the hip. I think they would have done a women's only pay-per-view this year or next year, either way. Specifically, when you look at kind of, again, the increased role of someone like a Michelle Wilson, because she has obviously been a strong advocate for this stuff. You know, she bothered to show up at the women's at the Royal Rumble and sit behind and be on camera there watching the women's Royal Rumble this year.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's a PR move in the sense that it's designed just to deflect attention from the Saudi show. I do think it is a PR move in the sense that they now have something they can tell the workers and they can tell analysts and other people about, oh, it's all the same. It's not a big deal that they're not there and that, you know, we're dealing with these cultural norms. I think, you know, just the fact that they got so deep into Mae Young Classic and other ideas at the time, it makes sense to hold the finals of a tournament like that at a big women's pay-per-view and other things. So it, to me, it's just part of kind of their larger decision that they made around splitting pay-per-views and going back to the consolidated pay-per-views and now reducing the number of pay-per-views that you have to find a way to kind of keep things interesting during the second half of the year as well.
Yeah, they certainly have enough talent, enough female talent to do an all-women's show.
They barely have enough female talent.
Well,
yeah. Because I think they promised something like 50 superstars would appear, which means you have to scrape a little bit to get there.
Well, I mean, you don't need 50 women to run on all women's show. You need like 8.
But I think they actually gave that number out saying how many would appear.
Sure. I'm just thinking about, like, well, why announce it now? I think part of this is the total wrestling culture of, you know, wrestling in the U.S., which is largely influenced by WWE. Like, you know, there's been all women's shows in Japan forever, and they've, you know, obviously All Japan Women did the Tokyo Dome in 1994. But, you know, they could have done this a little earlier than they did. And I think it's like, oh, yeah, we're doing the Saudi Arabia thing. It just makes too much sense to do it now.
Well, and they also could include it as part of their Q2 announcement. I mean, exactly. It was in the press release for Q2 as a key highlight for the year.
Right.
They mentioned the fact that they get some Saudi money here, you know, or that they're working in partnership with the Saudi thing. But then in, like, the next paragraph, there it is, the first ever all-women's pay-per-view event, WWE Evolution.
That's right.
You know, and they are focused on making sure that they can coincide some of their biggest announcements with when they're going to get the most attention. And hell, the stock is so hot right now, it gives them more attention. And so for all they know, they can start telling everyone, hey, everyone's so excited about the Women's Evolution pay-per-view. Look how hot our stock got.
Yeah. And I think there's something, not so much a cause, but I think there's something ironic about all this stuff about women's wrestling and this all-women's show. And hey, we announce it ourselves. The McMahons all come out and they make this announcement, and it's Stephanie McMahon who's making this history. It's sort of ironic that there's Saudi Arabia somehow involved in this, and all the stuff in Saudi Arabia about the women's ban being lifted on them being able to drive, but the Saudi government wants to make it sound like it's really the government that made this decision. It's not anything about, you know, protests or you know, people, you know, doing demonstrations and causing change. This is not about the little people here. This is all about the big people making the big decisions and deciding to, you know, honor you and give you this permission.
Yeah. One of the other things that was kind of interesting to me is when they started talking about on the call, Laura Martin asked George straight up, how is the health of the company when it comes to attendance? Because I look at your attendance numbers and they look like they're dropping. And so what she's referring to is the fact that if we go to the KPIs, we go down to the section on attendance, and we look here and we say, let's compare quarter over quarter. The red bars are 2018 and the blue bars are 2017. And so it says here that in 2018, Q2, WWE averaged 5,000 people for domestic house shows outside, or domestic shows, including TV shows, outside of WrestleMania. Last year, that number was 5,500, so that's negative 10%. Last quarter, it was 5,400 versus 6,000, so again, negative 10%. And so we're seeing a lot of declines. You know, if you look at the year-over-year trend here, it looks like it's a downward-sloping thing. And then he said, don't worry about it. George, I don't have George's exact quote here, but it was basically over a 12-month annual rolling basis, there's no issues going on. So I went ahead and fact-checked George. I went back. And it's surprising to me how difficult it is to get all the numbers you need to be able to say what was attendance by quarter at a good precision level, because you have to kind of roll together all sorts of different things where you have to look at the KPIs, you have to look at the 10Qs, you have to look at the 10Ks, because the 10Qs only come out three times a year. You have to combine all these different things to get these numbers, but then eventually you do get them. And so what I did is I found total live attendance, number of NA events, number of the average attendance for North America, the average ticket price for North America, the number of international events, the average international attendance, and the average international ticket price. And I went through all these things, and then I said, let me come up with 4 years of comparison. And we'll use a rolling time period. So it starts in Q3 and ends in Q2. So I can compare four different periods. So from 2014 to 2015, 15 to 16, 16 to 17, 17 to 18. So total attendance in 2014 to 2015, when you start halfway through the year and go to the second half of the next year, there's about 1.9 million people who came to events. That's 268 events. That's an average of 7,200 people. Next year, the number went up 2 million, 2.05, 269 events. So only one more event held. Attendance actually went up 7,600. Year after that, 2.2 million people. So that's a higher number, right? That's a good number.
Mm-hmm.
303 events. Uh-oh. Our attendance dropped to 7,200. Well, this year, over the last four quarters, they have averaged 2.086 million people. Or they have an average. They've amassed.
Total.
They've ran 317 events, and this does not include NXT. This is exclusive of NXT.
Yeah, main roster only.
Main roster only, and they have dropped to 6,582 people per show. Now, that is an incredible number when you compare it to New Japan, when you compare it to Ring of Honor, when you compare it to TNA, when you compare it to any other wrestling organization in the world. Mm-hmm. For an average to average 6,582 people per show.
Yeah.
So
just that average is bigger than all but the biggest shows that New Japan runs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like their Cow Palace show did this once.
Yes.
And that was it.
Yeah. Even in Japan, 6,000 is a big show for them.
Yeah. They average about 2,500 according to my calculations.
Yeah.
Especially when you X out the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah.
But that number is down 10%, 9.5% decline. And when you look at it on a North American basis, it's about a 2% overall decline and a 7% per event decline. So their average shows, we're averaging 5,900 for North America, then they dropped to 5,700, and now it's 5,400. And internationally, the 69 events that they've done, and they did 69 events last year as well, so it's not even more events, they're down 16%. They dropped from 6,600 to 5,500.
Yeah.
When George was asked about this, he said, oh, it's just venue mix. It's just venue mix.
Don't worry about it.
You could argue, okay, internationally, maybe that is venue mix. Is maybe there is a big difference between do you run India? Do you run China? Do you go to South America? Do you run more events in Europe? I'll call that venue mix. That's fair. But what I don't agree with is to say that in North America, it's really venue mix right now, because the fact that they've lost 7% of their average attendance year over year after holding steady for a while, and they've added more events, to me starts saying, wow, what else are they doing? And the other thing that will jump out when you start looking at this is ticket price. We go back to 2014, our ticket price for WWE, the average North American ticket price was sitting at $49. The next year it shot up to $53. The next year, it shot up to $58. The next year, it shot up to $58. The next year, it's sitting much, much higher. This quarter was $82 compared to last quarter. This time was $78. Last quarter, the time before, was $82. And the quarter before that was $47. But 62 is probably the relevant quarter to look at. So what I'm afraid of is basically WWE, their value for live events has gone way up, mm-hmm. but that has come at the expense of basically beginning to lose some attendance. And I think they need to recognize right now that they could be at that inflection point.
Yeah. So why is this happening?
I think because they're pursuing obviously a price volume mix model. Mm-hmm. So part of it is that they decided, hey, I'm going to try to run more events. I'm going to try to price up my tickets at each of the events. I'm going to try to squeeze more money out of the hardcore fans. Mm-hmm. I was reviewing one of WWE's old investor presentations yesterday, and it was, you know what the ratio in their mind is in the United States between casual and lapsed fans as a group versus hardcore fans?
I don't know. They half the population is a casual fan to them.
Well, half the population is a fan. Mm-hmm. So half the population is a non-fan. Half of it is a fan. And then you have three subgroups within fans. You have casual, you have lapsed, and you have hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
So, or they don't call it hardcore. I don't remember what they call it.
Passionate.
Passionate. Yes, thank you. So what is the ratio, do you think, between passionate fans and that other group of casual or lapsed? 1 to 2, 1 to 5? What number?
What do I think it is, or what I think they think it is?
Well, what do you think they're claiming?
I think they think, I don't know. 15% passionate. I have trouble even parsing, like, what's the difference between a casual and a lapsed fan?
But yeah, and I'm just putting them into one group, to be honest.
But let's imagine we know what that means. 15% passionate, let's say, 20% lapsed, and the rest casual. I don't know.
So that would put about 35% in your one category,
yeah,
and then 15 in the other.
Yeah.
So a little less than a 1-to-3 ratio. I believe when I reviewed it, it was actually a 1-to-4 ratio, mm-hmm. meaning they thought there was three times more, the group of people that are out there that are just casual or lapsed. I think it was like 10 million in one category, 30 million in the other two categories. I'm sorry, 40 million in the other two categories, and then about 50 million on the other side. Mm-hmm. And that just struck me to say that in WWE's own mind, they're only getting about a quarter of the people that they could get for wrestling. And what are they doing now is that they're raising the ticket prices on that quarter of the group that they can get higher and higher and higher. And as a result, we're seeing attendance start to drop. Now, for them, it's a valuable thing because they're getting more revenue. But what I think is going to be important is that if their three projects and their three objectives continue to be, like George said, one, grow the audience, two, maintain the audience you have, deepen the engagement you have, and three, monetize the product. Well, you know what? They're going to make so much money on the TV deal that they need to spend a lot more time thinking about what the heck is the point of a live event and who do they want to come to live events. Because I do think it's going to hurt them in the long run when they're running Monday night house shows that are drawing, you know, 1,200 people, and that when they're pricing people out of the marketplace to create this new generation of people that want to watch live events for wrestling.
Yeah, but I mean, like, what's the ultimate cause here about why attendance is down? Like, what draws people to – what makes people want to go to a WWE Live event or decide not to? I think it's it has a lot to do with who are my favorite wrestlers going to be there? And we can think right off the bat, well, John Cena is not working that many house shows anymore. And then, you know, we know that John Cena – we've got studies out there that show that John Cena is a real strong house show draw. He's not on shows that much anymore. And meanwhile, on TV, you've got I'm just going to adjust this audio. And meanwhile, on TV, we've got, you know, Roman Reigns. They're trying their hardest to make Roman Reigns this big star, and he's a big star to a degree, but he's certainly not the star that John Cena was. And there's a lot of fan backlash over what they're doing with the TV and what stars they're pushing. And I think
and when you think about how high wrestling skews when it comes to the different demographic groups, it always skewed the highest with the lowest income demographics. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you are running a fool's errand if you continue to kind of drive out your more ardent fans if they cannot afford to bring their family to a wrestling event. Yeah. And so especially with this new model with TV rights, I do think they should be really rethinking whether or not that they may have pursued the strategy of price over volume or price and volume over, you know, actual raw attendance a little bit too much. And that's the kind of thing that I think Vince McMahon as a promoter, he was always obsessed with, you know, what is the attendance going on at these events and using that as a core metric for the health of his business. And so I do hope that when we're getting back to our original discussion, what is the connection between a George Barros in this world is I hope he wouldn't say, hey, it's all fine. It's venue mix. Don't worry about it. Rather than saying, oh my God, this is something I really should be thinking about, because even the least, you know, even the woman who refers to our developmental league as next.
Who's an analyst, not somebody who works for the company, but yeah. What do you think George's response should be to that question? I mean, if you're on this conference call, you're in this PR mode or investor relations mode, what do you say to that? Like, is there a better answer to that other than don't worry about it? The venue mix was the reason?
Well, I think you could honestly answer the question by saying, well, look, hey, last year we ran, over the last quarter here, we ran 317 events. And the year before we only ran 300. And I want to make it clear that we are so dedicated to growing our business. We've increased the number of events and the number of places we go in the world by 5%. And this year we're going to run a total of, you know, come up with some huge number. Let's see, NXT last year ran a total of, let's see, I have the number on my spreadsheet here, ran a total of 188 events last year. So if you assume that they have already run a total of 386 other events, and then we add in the NXT events that they've run, which I should have here for the last four quarters, they ran a total of 194 NXT events over this time. So I would just talk about the fact that, you know, we ran 580 events this past year, and we are continuing to go into new markets around the world. And what we're seeing in America is a combination of our opportunity that we've used to raise our ticket prices and to make sure that we're being able to monetize and give the best experience to our fans, to put smiles on their faces. And you know what? You're absolutely right that we are going to continue to monitor this and make sure that we understand that we have the best opportunity for people. And hell, I've created this new program called the WWE VIP Experience that does this. And I've made this opportunity for young families to do this. And, you know, just really break it down as a way that you're talking about it in a meaningful way rather than you're just talking about it in a don't worry about it, look over here. And the one thing that you were saying about John Cena and other stars really made me think it's so deceptive to me that the GSA money is in here because people then look at it and immediately say, oh, so-and-so is a star. So-and-so is driving up money on this element of the business. When we look at it, live events is flat this over the last four quarters compared to the four quarters before it. It's not growing right now. You know, it was 109.4 this quarter over the last four, and a year ago it was 109.3. It's absolutely dead flat. And so to me, in fact, internationals dropped 3 million. I'm sorry, that was the North American number. Internationals dropped 3 million, and ticket and advertising and sponsorship is down by 0.1, and the other category is up by like 1.3 million. So I'm seeing live events as stagnant in my book. Mm-hmm. And maybe stagnant's okay because it's healthy, but I would just say I would really, really push back on the idea that everything's fine, look somewhere else.
Yeah,
I don't think that's an honest answer.
Yeah, I think it's money left on the table if their TV did a better job of creating stars and making more wrestlers fans' favorite wrestler. You'd have more ticket sales. You'd have if this product was perceived as cool and had a better relationship with its fans, it had more goodwill with its fans, it would be a cooler product. You have more kids getting into it. You'd be giving birth to more fans that are going to be fans long term. Still got some of that, and the business is okay, but it is what it is here, and you've got such enormous TV rights. You've got things like oil money coming in that it makes you have little incentive to change very much.
What I would love to see them do is if they ever did go back to splitting out their revenue by various sources, because I think there's a very strong argument that, hey, the four quarters ending in Q2 2015 and the four quarters ending in Q2 2016, they only did about 55, 57 international events. Last 2 years, they've done 69.
Yeah, so Harry in the chat wants to know, are too many events a factor? And what's the domestic versus international breakdown in terms of added events? I think you're about to talk about
that. They added about, that was what I was getting to. They've added about 12 international events a year, and they've added somewhere on the scale of 34 to 50 domestic events. Mm-hmm. So it's mostly domestic that you're going to see the added events coming from. But they've added about 12 international events, which is down from where they were maybe 10 years ago when they had a big run in Europe. But it's up from where they were the last couple of years. And what that says to me is that you do have marketplaces like China, India, sometimes the Middle East, where you're running events that you would not necessarily categorize as core markets for this business, but they're emerging markets, right? Same with South Africa. They ran this last year, and they haven't run there for a while. There's certain marketplaces that they like to go to. And so I do think it would make more sense if you're saying, let's look at UK market, let's look at the European market, let's look at all the other countries of the world market, or even, you know, the Japanese market, and create this definition of these are developed wrestling markets, these are undeveloped wrestling markets, and then compare them a little bit more. But the fact that we're seeing, and I go back to my attendance spreadsheet here, 16% decline on international attendance and a 7% decline. And this is not a one quarter number. This is four quarters over four quarters. I just, to me, it should just give you a little bit of a twinge of pain about maybe they've overexpanded. And this would include ideas like, hey, let's run 205 live house shows. Let's run, you know, other ideas that maybe are going to be okay for the marketplace here. And Monday night house shows for SmackDown. And it's just always that question of, are you beating up the guys for the value you're getting if television is your main deal? Keep in mind, they're getting $4 million a week for SmackDown pretty soon. So a $4 million show. I mean, we were just talking about it last week. Wasn't it that there was never even a WCW show that did $1 million on live gate?
That's right. They did a few $900,000 gates. Of course, this is all late 90s money. But yeah, they never did $1 million gate in WCW.
Yeah. So it's just that idea of being like, you know, now SmackDown, and it's a gate versus live event. So it would be pay-per-view really that we should compare it to, like the Starcade or something. But it's just funny to me that it's like now every week SmackDown is going to be doing a $4 million value if you really think about it.
Yep. Which is like what are they doing right now, you think? In terms of like per episode.
How much do they get today?
Yeah.
Well, we could actually figure it out. So on our sheet here, we get a number for core content rights. It says our core content rights worldwide are 66.2 million for this last quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure that's going to be about 26 shows, right? Because it's 13 Raws and 13 SmackDowns.
Yep.
So if I divide it, it's about 2.5 million per show.
So how do you break what's the worldwide ratio?
And then we figure that domestically, let's say about 60% of our money is domestic. Oh, maybe 1.5 million is my guess. And especially if we think about it being about 4 million and we know that it's increased by 3.6 or 2.6, might be a better estimate, be about 1.5. So I think we're getting to the same number either way.
Yeah.
Up a million per show.
Yeah, I get if you just divide like 4 million divided by 3.6, I get 1.1.
Well, I'm doing it by 2.6 because one of those factors is already included in itself.
Okay.
If I was doing 100, they say 3.6. I really think the number that you and I should use is closer probably to 2.6.
Okay. And then I get 1.5 million.
Yeah, and I think that's closer to what, you know, if I say here 66 million divided by 26 shows, and I say that I think about 60% of it's domestic, I get 1.5 million as well.
Yep.
So coming at it two different ways, 1.5 million is kind of where I'm landing. Mm-hmm. And again, it's always different because, you know, SmackDown gets probably the SmackDown money that they got when they signed up the original contract. Then they went moved to USA, and then they went live. So we don't know if they got more money each time they did that, or Raw added a third hour, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, but it just strikes me to say it's a big increase for WWE for where they are. Overall, though, the health of some of these other things, they're not as strong as maybe in a continuously escalating valuation would justify. Here's the social media numbers. If we look at the difference on the blue line, which is the
Twitter.
Is Twitter, yeah. So 5 million account creation years before, 10, 11, 9, 7, 6, or 6, 9 million, 9 million, 12 million. That's the averages over the last like 10 quarters. And this one they did 5, which is half of what they've grown every other time. Facebook's growth is even more anemic. They only did 2 million new accounts, whereas the quarter before they did 10. And going back, they were averaging more like 10. And part of that is because Mixed Match Challenge kind of stopped. And you can see the difference between when you're doing a big show on Facebook and when you're not. But to me, that's a little bit alarming in the fact that they believe so strongly in social media. And to me, this says, hey, things are slowing down some. And maybe you're reaching a new normal, a new saturation point. But maybe you're also, you know, getting to the point where bot and locked account and fake account creation is not going to be able to kind of drive your numbers astronomically higher every single quarter. And in addition, maybe just like the attendance number, this should be a red flag that someone should say, hey, I need to deal with this today rather than be shameful about it in a year from now.
Yeah. Well, as we know, you did an article on this that you know, Twitter did this crackdown on fake accounts or
but
whatever.
But that was for this quarter.
Oh, that's right. So this one, okay.
What others have mentioned to me tangentially is that there have been other Twitter crackdowns over the last year here, that they are going after other sets of accounts. Hmm. But no, that would not even include the change for this time, in my opinion. So that's a concern.
With Twitter itself, like I kind of know this off the top of my head, Twitter users have kind of plateaued in terms of that entire platform. Their user base has not grown to the extent that Facebook has. I guess we could look into like how's Facebook user growth going, and how's that compare? I guess that would be like the comparison to do, right? Is like take quarter to quarter, take these numbers, WWE's numbers quarter to quarter, and compare them to the percentage differences of Twitter and of Facebook quarter to quarter. Which
goodness, if only we had a new media expert in here who was good at being able to take his stock portfolio. And not only do that, but look at those filings for that stock portfolio and say, hey, I bet your Facebook reports every quarter how much people. The other one I would love you to look at it, when you do that, if you could also do a graph that included Netflix.
Okay.
I would love to see what the Netflix numbers are domestically and internationally.
I'll tell you what, we'll do that. This will be my homework assignment for next weekend.
Excellent. Excellent. So, okay. for those of you who listen to the premium show and are like, well, what's the value of listening to this extra show? It's because I assign you homework.
That's right. This is the TV show. That's the pay-per-view. You got to buy the pay-per-view.
Yeah. Just any other kind of big takeaways here for this last quarter? I'm just going through the statements and the biggest things. Vince's comments for the quarter were pretty anemic. He seemed very lackluster and out of energy.
Yeah.
We've read some sort of slide tournament here. Anything else?
A tournament of sorts, the Mae Young Classic. We announced WWE Evolution, which will be an all women's pay per view. We're going to do Super Showdown in Australia. It's going to be great.
It's going to have the most talent that's ever appeared on that continent.
Yeah. They're doing localized stuff in Spanish, Portuguese, German, I thought Arabic.
This was really interesting, especially the fact that Portuguese is mentioned. Mm.
Brazil.
Because Brazil, yeah. And so I'm wondering if this is part of the Fox Sports Latin America deal they have, or whether this is a specific deal with the Brazilian broadcaster or what. But that really intrigued me. Mm-hmm. I'm also curious when they say we're producing WWE now in Arabic, you know, are they producing that in-house here? Or are they producing it in like OSN or someone else overseas is doing it?
Yeah. We don't know.
Not so much that it makes a big difference, but I'm just kind of curious myself. One thing that really intrigued me and something I've been bringing up is in the earnings statement. Let me see if I can find it. Capital. Yes, this one. So they mentioned that in early 2018, management discussed a step up in capital expenditures to build out.
Can you zoom in on that?
What's that?
Can you zoom in on that?
Yes. There we go. Is that better?
Yes.
To build out the company's video production infrastructure and support the company's growth, the company has decided that spending. To delay that spending as plans continue to evolve. And no, it doesn't mean that's a new home for Evolve. But what that interests me is basically then they admitted, well, we told everybody we were going to spend a lot of money. And then we didn't go and spend it. And at the same time, hey, everybody, we're going to be able to raise our outlook by to 160 to 170. And that's going to beat our old outlook of 150. And so if you really think about that, what they did is they said, hey, we're not going to spend $5 or $10 million. And by the way, our outlook is now $5 to $10 million better. We are doing an excellent job in our business. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit of smoke and mirrors in my book, because you're basically telling people, hey, we're going to spend a lot of money, and then you're not doing it. And then you're coming back and being like, look, I can improve my profit. Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't. You told us you were going to do one thing, and then you did something else. So it's not so much I should be impressed that you're really good at managing everything, as much as I should be impressed that you're really good at being able to give us back the money that you're not spending.
Yeah, this is like a general finance question, I guess. But like, is there such a thing as like too much profit? Like, if you're making all this profit or adjusted EBITDA, whatever you want to measure it as. Is there a point where, like, you should be saying as a company, why aren't we doing more with this money that we've got here to reinvest it in the company to make the company even stronger?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that you know, there's a lot of management that's been written on that about how much of it should go to stockholders, how much of it should be going to reinvestment, and, you know, mm-hmm. that's the whole idea, and how much should go to, you know, the equivalent of an R&D type thing.
How much of it should go to the pay of the wrestlers?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could almost say that maybe some of it is similar to, you know, instead of calling it R&D, let's call it a combination of social media, like that the digital media will be half our R&D budget and the other half will be some amount of the performance center of just money that we're spending on talent that we don't know whether it's ever going to pay off.
Yeah.
But that was just another thing that kind of stuck out to me. And then the last piece is, and this was something that just really jumped out to me when I was looking at typing in all these things here, the stock comp numbers. So this is how much of the stop compensation numbers are being boiled into WWE's operating income to adjusted OIBDA a walk.
What, so they what always is stock compensation? Is it this dividend payments?
So no. So what they have here is they have kind of three lines. They have adjustments, which is going to be things like when they do non-recurring, non-cash abandonment charges. There's going to be the depreciation and amortization, and then there's going to be the line that they call stock comp. And my belief of what stock comp meant was, I don't know if it's defined here, stock compensation, is that I would think that this has more to do with the executive management compensation that they do, the added costs.
Stock compensation is a way corporations use stock options to reward employees. Employees with stock options need to know whether their stock is vested and will retain its full value even if they are no longer employed with that company. Yeah, so it's stock bonuses.
Okay, so I guessed right on that one. So
and we do see 2015, like, and we do see every quarter we see those like the Form 4, right? Form 4s will come out and each member of the board of directors gets some stock. All those top executives get reported as receiving stock. Barrios, Wilson, Dunn,
and they just sold all of theirs on the 23rd, on Monday of this week, in fact.
Yeah.
All their options vested on the 20th on a Friday, and we saw a huge sell-off on the 23rd, which included, you know, Kevin Dunn selling millions of dollars, and George Barrios, and Michelle Wilson, and Mark Cowell, or Cowell.
Cowell,
and Stephanie McMahon, and Triple H, and lots of other people, Michael Selick. So the stock comp cost in 2015 was 17.2. In 2016 was 18.2. In 2017 was 24 million. In 2018 was already is 22.5 million. And if you look at it kind of year over year, it went from 21 million to 33 million already, or 34 million already. Mm-hmm. So their stock comp number has gone way up, even as the adjusted OIBDA number has jumped from 103 to probably 165 annually. And if you take out the GSA money, probably still 154. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting to me to say, you know, what we're also seeing here at the same time is that WWE is rewarding its top executives more and more, even as they hold back on spending on some of these things, which, again, you know, maybe it's the right amount to reward them, but maybe there could be an argument made that, hey, you should double your dividend. Hey, you should be reinvesting more in the future of what this business is going to look like. And maybe the point of not spending on this capital expenditure project is to have a better outlook for what the future is going to look like for WWE. So it's not all bad that they're not spending. It just I just want to make it clear to people that this quarter looks really good because they have a bunch of Saudi Arabia money. They chose not to spend the money that they said they were going to spend. And at the same time, their live event is kind of flat. Their consumer products are down. And it's all coming from the fact that they're just basically pushing more and more volume through on television, and they get guaranteed escalation.
Yeah. Do you think wrestler pay has increased to the same degree that executive and stock compensation has increased? Executive pay?
I cannot say. I would say that the payment to independent contractors probably has not increased at the rate that the payment to lawyers has.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely.
Yeah, I think it's unlikely as well. So that's where we stand today. How long have we been broadcasting, Grant?
We have been broadcasting for 1 hour and 8 minutes.
Oh, well, that's great. So let's just go back to our original topic, our starting thesis, our starting discussion. George Barrios, does he have a good feel for this business? Is he a smart cookie, or is he someone that you should be worried about if he takes the helm of this company as Vince McMahon increasingly checks out?
I don't think so. I think he as far as the business side, just the guy who's really in charge of making decisions and driving the direction of what WWE is going to do as far as, I don't know, it's like its business infrastructure. I think he's done a great job, and we've inducted him into the WrestleNomics Hall of Fame because of that. But I think
unilaterally.
But I think, you know, the big thing that's going to drive the future and the health of this company is TV rights. But after that, I think you've got to create some stars. And I don't know, this company's done a lot to strengthen its brand and make its, you know, they used the word moat, I saw, for the first time.
Yes, yes, that they've created a moat around themselves at one point,
yeah,
right?
You know, it's all about strengthening this brand and bringing the McMahons out, and the McMahons are the ones who make history. And there's not so much about making, you know, getting stars over, except for the stars that Vince McMahon wants to get over. And he and the fans kind of know what he's doing there, and they don't feel the same way about Roman Reigns as he does, apparently. And he's got enough money and enough profit to be stubborn about it and to just insist on doing what he's doing. Maybe Braun Strowman is coming up, but then I don't know. They kind of like beat Braun Strowman. Brock Lesnar beat Braun Strowman last year. Maybe he's cooled off a little bit. He's become a little bit more of a caricature, just the guy who destroys things. And
what I'd also say is, to me, it just comes down to the fundamental interplay between business to business and direct to consumer. Mm-hmm. And if you have a good understanding of how you're going to strengthen each of those, great. Mm-hmm. I think they've done an incredible job of improving their business to business financials. Yeah. You know, that's why when we look at that ratio of what's going to drive this business forward, it's about guaranteed contractual payments. That's wonderful for them. What I worry about is that they are completely losing the value of almost half of their business around that DTC side. And there are changes. There are fundamental evolution that's going on in this business right now.
No pun intended.
And I worry about the fact that, you know, when you look at it, I was reviewing the old Observer numbers. What did it say? 414,000 Bullet Club shirts were sold last year by Hot Topic?
Yep. That's what we found. Yep.
WWE would kill to sell 414,000 shirts of somebody at a secondary location like that.
What does that come out to in revenue? If say it's like $25 a shirt, 414,000 times $25 comes out to $10.3 million, $10.4 million.
Yeah, and I would assume that you're getting maybe somewhere on the range of 5 to 10% on that as the holder.
But so, you count that as that revenue, right?
What's that?
You would count that as revenue, though.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the value that New Japan actually gets is probably much less.
Yeah.
Is maybe 5 or 10% of that number.
Sure. But, I mean, you could compare that to, like, venue merch numbers. Their venue merch this quarter was, what, 8 million? Is that what I'm seeing here? Yeah, 7.8 million?
Yep, 7.8 million. Yeah. So it's a non-negligible amount. You would care about that $1 million.
Yeah.
And just the fact that, you know, that we saw them try to copy it with the Balor Club, you know, it says a lot about the value of something like a Bullet Club out there.
Right.
And so I just worry about making sure that someone is thinking about both. Now, if it turns out that George is the guy that cares about the B2B relationships and Michelle is the woman who cares about the DTC relationship, and we strengthen both of them over time, great. Then we're good. Yeah. I just want to make sure that's on the minds of the people who are looking at this business right now. And to me, when we go back and we see that graph, we say, over this last year here, this is what has happened to this stock. It just frightens me because part of me says, so much is baked into these numbers already. I don't understand what could be baked in that we don't know yet. And yet it keeps going higher and higher. As if to say, well, maybe India will exceed expectations and the UK will exceed expectations. And to me, I keep thinking, well, if it's possible for it to go higher because it exceeds expectations, doesn't mean it's possible for it to crash when it doesn't exceed expectations.
Yeah. When news about UK will be first, right? UK will be out by the end of this year. Yes. India will be out by the middle of next year. I think we could see some disappointment with either of those deals. It's not going to be the degree of crash that we saw in 2014, though, because it's the U.S. deal is done, you know, and that's by far the biggest. So there could be some crash here when news about those deals
honestly,
is learned.
The number two biggest deal for WWE today is GSA money.
Bigger than so that Saudi Arabia deal is bigger than the UK or the India TV deals on an annual basis. Is that what you're saying?
I need to go back to my notes and check.
And we're going to guess, okay, say 50 million plus another 10 million at the end of the year, a total of like $70 million on a year?
No, 60 million is my guess. Okay. 60 million net for a year.
So 60 million is bigger than the total payments in a year from either India or the UK?
I think so. Gotta go back and check my numbers.
Okay.
But I think so.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I could be wrong.
That's a big deal.
But it's just that idea to me that it's funny that this Saudi Arabia money is technically their second largest deal, and most people can't even pull it out of their spreadsheet, their financial spreadsheets, because the way they're trying to hide it.
Yeah. Well, they don't want Russell Knox to analyze it, so I understand.
Yeah. So and I've even, you know, when I talked to this reporter, he didn't understand that. And yeah. And the first thing he asked me is, well, is there other countries of the world that they're going to get deals like that for? Maybe that Australia deal.
No.
And you know what, when I heard Australia, what I did? I laughed. And I had to be like, no, Australia is not going to go give them $60 million like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Australia is not trying to divert people's attention from women's rights in their home country.
Yeah.
So they'll give them a subsidy just the way at WrestleMania gets subsidies. But right. They're not going to give them a giant other.
Well, what they need to do is they need to get a relationship with the DPRK. And you know, the DPRK needs to get some big, you know, global PR campaign going so that people like their country better. And then, hey man, it happened in 1995.
You know, DKRP,
the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. We're talking about North Korea here, of course.
Yeah, Chosen-Inmon Kangkuwaku is the native language name. I represented North Korea for Model UN. For several years. We were the PLO, we were North Korea, and we were Cyprus.
Oh my goodness.
Those were some of my favorite countries. But I especially enjoyed being North Korea and but, you know, I just read an article in the Washington Post today, I think it was, about somebody – no, maybe it was GQ. Actually, I think it was GQ. And it was about how somebody was at the big Aspen conference. That's like a big security conference that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And their Uber driver would ask them every time that they got in the car all about North Korea, to the point that they became worried that the woman might actually be a spy.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, maybe that's what – so it led me to think, you know, the next WrestleNomics initiative is that we should be recruiting Stamford, Connecticut Uber drivers to be part of our information network.
Well, there you go. That's something we can get on for next week as well. But
plus think of all those people who are going to Titan Towers, you know, right. you'd get a inside knowledge of all them.
Or, you know what I could do? Just go to Stanford and I'm a registered Uber driver or something and Lyft. I've never given a ride, but I could do some covert action there. But seriously, this is concerning and this is big news. I think if they're getting $60 million a year and that's bigger, if that really is bigger than, you know, the annual value of the UK or India deals, then that's a really big deal. And if it's something that's so important that it's going to, you know, help them with their reporting of their business, then they're at risk to like start to become dependent on it. Right. And to make decisions that please that business partner. And this business partner is, a very morally fraught business partner that they're dealing with here.
Well, I'm pulling up. I stopped my screen share so I could pull up some private email.
Okay.
And just try to check some of my old numbers that I used to email out to, you know, when Vince used to email me and say, Chris, what exactly is the size of our deal? And I say, oh, Vince, here's the numbers that you emailed me a while ago.
Vince McMahon emails you from time to time?
All the time. Oh. You know. In fact, okay, here, you want to get crazy here. The combination of UK and India is equal to approximately the Saudi Arabia deal.
The combination. That's a big deal.
Yeah. They're old deal, mind you. So 30 million plus.
So like what year are we talking about here?
The last year of their deal.
So 2017.
Oh, no. I was talking about their 2019 number.
Who's 2019 number? Oh, so, okay. The last year of the current cycle. Okay. Gotcha.
In theory, my estimate.
Yeah.
My estimate. So you know, it I would say if India or the UK doubled their deal, they'd be close to GSA money. And I just feel like that's a good example of where maybe there's not enough transparency going through on this 10-year deal for people to understand that is such a market mover. That's such a material difference.
Yeah. So that's something that really should have, and maybe it already did. It should really affect the stock prices.
Well, I would argue the reason that things are so hot right now is because when you look at their value that they've generated for this quarter, it shocked people to see how could they be so high on, you know, how could they grow so much year over year. They grew from a four quarter number of 40. Sorry, what number is this combined? 500.9 million was their media the last four quarters. And then this time around, it was 613.2. Mm-hmm. So they grew by 100 million there. Now, if you took out the GSA money, it was probably they grew to maybe 568. Now, 568 over the last four, the year before, is still a 13% growth. It's still a healthy amount of growth, but there's a big difference between when you're growing, 48%? Let me check here. What is it, that total number? Yeah, when you're growing 22% and when you're growing 13%. Mm-hmm. It's a big driver for this quarter. And so that was part of the reason. And it's driving up their outlook, obviously, a lot. And that's going to be a big part of it is the $11 million more of operating income that I'm estimating they're getting from this GSA deal. Mm-hmm. I want to thank Harry, who did pull up some Facebook numbers for us here. And I just got to try to see if I can parse what this means. Facebook monthly active users Q2 up 38 million versus an average of plus 63 million over the prior quarters. So they were growing almost at half the rate that they normally grew at. Mm-hmm. A little less than half, but yeah, or more than half. Twitter Q2 MAU, I don't know what MAU stands for. Do you?
No.
Okay. Down 1 million versus average of plus 366 million. So that's not good. And then Netflix monthly active users, MAU. And then Netflix is 8 million up versus 6.3 quarters.
Yeah.
So it looks like Netflix is growing much faster than others are, though I know Netflix always has the international side to lean on a little bit differently. Right. And thank you, Harry. Yes. MAU. I figured it out.
Yes.
So to me, it says that Facebook growth for WWE might be in line with Facebook overall. I would love to see. And again, their mantra has always been to get a disproportionate share, right? That they're doing better than they
get more than our fair share.
Yeah, that's what they say. And to their credit, that's the R&D they did 5-7 years ago, yeah, is the decision to go deep in social media. Yeah. And it's paying off for them, in my opinion, now, especially when it comes to younger fans, which are not captured by those television demographics.
Yeah. I mean, I strongly believe that whenever some new media emerges, one of the first things that can exploit the value of that new media is professional wrestling. And the history of professional wrestling bears that out.
Yeah, but at the same time, our presentation method of professional wrestling sometimes lags even more.
Oh, definitely.
You know, that you know, it still looks like the 2010 product.
Absolutely, it does, especially when you've got no incentive to really change and push that vision forward. So my dream team is George Berrios, Michelle Wilson, and Paul Levesque in charge of creative. I think this is, what is this, a $6.5 billion company? I don't know how to calculate it, but I think this is maybe $7 billion company if you've got somebody creating stars and driving creative who knows what they're doing in terms of, you know, drawing fan interest.
All right, folks, we're going to wrap up this call so Brandon can get back to packing and get back to moving to South Talanawanda.
Yeah.
You've been listening to WrestleNomics Radio. I am your co-host, Christopher Mukigana Harrington, joined by Brandon Howard Thurston.
Yeah.
In this little box right here for the last time, by that wall socket, by that very loud air conditioning unit, by the washing machine of doom. By the washing machine outside his window.
That's right. We won't have that much ambient noise in this new apartment. There's a, I'm in, I think it's a three home unit, but it's very much like this three home house that's been very much remodeled, and it's in a recovering section of Buffalo, New York. So now, no on-site laundry to make noise, no air conditioner whatsoever. If there's going to be air conditioning noise, it's going to be from me purchasing my own air conditioner unit. So yeah. From now on, we'll be broadcasting. I will be broadcasting live from Buffalo, New York.
patreon.com/WrestleNomics, $5 a month, and you get access to things like all of our financials, our spreadsheets, the other AV thing we did on this, mm-hmm, plus ability to communicate with us all the time, mm-hmm, and get all the new breaking news. And hopefully next week I'm talking to you about my the newspaper article where I was terribly misquoted, and I started a feud with George Berrios that caused WrestleMomics Radio to be kicked off the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network.
Oh, that'll never happen. But yeah, but thanks to Harry and William, our good friend William, for joining us in the chat and giving us comments and questions. And
thank you, everyone.
Yeah.
Have a great day. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.